I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN. Growing up, children begin to consider what career or life path they might choose as an adult, usually a profession they admire: school teacher, firefighter, police officer, musician, dancer, nurse, doctor. But as life moves forward, plans change. Life takes us in many different directions. I'm sure early on, our guest today on Better Than Monkeys had no idea his life would lead in such an unusual and interesting and otherworldly direction. Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Hanna, and welcome to a special Halloween edition of Better Than Monkeys from WQLN NPR. Today's guest, Pastor Robin Swope, has spent most of his adult life as a Christian minister in both mainline and evangelical denominations. He served as a minister in Burkina Faso and ministered to the homeless in New York City's Hell's Kitchen. He's currently the pastor of Bountiful Community Church in Bountiful, Utah. Sounds pretty normal so far, doesn't it? Well, here's where that changes. While in seminary, Robin Swope was asked to participate in his first exorcism, a man who he says transformed into five different characters. This event began an intense interest in the paranormal, and today, Robin Swope is a seminary-trained exorcist, an author of seven books, an advisor for paranormal investigation teams and television programs, as well as a journalist contributing to various publications. Today on Better Than Monkeys, Pastor Swope joins us to talk about local legends, spirits, things that go bump in the night, and yes, exorcisms. Please join me in welcoming to Better Than Monkeys the paranormal pastor himself, Robin Swope. Reverend Robin Swope joining us here on Better Than Monkeys. Hello, welcome to Better Than Monkeys. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks.
So you've got some Erie connections. You grew up and were born and grew up here in Erie, and you are a pastor at a local church. The reason we have you on is not necessarily, well, a little bit for your ministerial prowess, but because of your interest in the paranormal. Is that unusual for a minister to have interest in otherworldly things?
Really what it is, it's the supernatural. So it really does tie in, but there is a big stigma about unorthodoxy and stuff that does not go with dogma.
Well, in a few minutes, we'll talk about some of the local Erie legends, because you are originally from the Erie, Pennsylvania area. But you are a minister. You are a seminary-trained exorcist. Now, a lot of religions put, let's say, blinders on when it comes to possibilities for where your soul goes after you pass away. We know of heaven and hell and probably purgatory as the general big three. So how do you reconcile the fact that the church thinks when you die, you go someplace, and the fact that there may be spirits or souls still wandering the earth?
We know it's really interesting when you get to the dogma of the church and the belief, some of it really doesn't jive with scripture when you look at it in a historical and cultural context. Most of our spirituality in theology in the Bible comes from ancient Sumeria and ancient Egypt. In Egypt, especially the afterlife and being righteous, being able to get to the afterlife because you do have a kind heart that is as light as a feather. And Sumeria was very pessimistic because of the different weather and climate that it had at the time. Flooding would happen all the time out of nowhere. So you have a mix there that we forgot. A lot of the spirituality about spirits and demons and death and all that comes from Sumeria. A lot of pastors avoid it because they're afraid of the unknown, and because of horror movies, really. You know, there's a lot of the stuff that people take as, especially in the paranormal field, there are a lot of people who say that they're pastors. A lot of them just have a Universal Life internet, you know, certificate,
right,
but no real training or historical context or anything like that. I focus on history and sociology, not dogma, because dogma changes, people do not, and history is a pattern. So you can see where things come from with history. But for me, instead of fear, I'm fascinated by it. You have to be careful. with the paranormal, because there are things out there in the Judeo-Christian worldview that does come from Sumeria and Egypt. We are not alone in this world. We live in a world that's full of things around us, spirits and forces, and the Apostle Paul called them principalities and powers. So some are benevolent, and some are very malevolent, and some are tricksters. And so it's very interesting to see all that. My background, I come from the Christian Missionary Alliance. I'm now with the United Church of Christ. But with the Christian Missionary Alliance, they come from the more supernatural background. They don't so much as believe in like the gift of tongues, but in healing and supernatural healing and all that. So that opened up for me in seminary, and I got involved in the Vineyard Movement, which was signs and wonders from the Fuller Theological Seminary in the 80s. And I saw a lot of things, and I've encountered supernatural things at least once a year. UFOs, time displacement, both me and my son, weird shadow creatures, and sometimes just odd, weird things.
You've encountered enough weird things that you've written 7 books, which you can find on Amazon. If you just look up Robin Swope on Amazon, you can find any of his books there on Amazon. And they cover the gamut of just about everything from Slender Man, which is a popular legend right now, onto eerie things in Erie, Pennsylvania. So it's a wonderful collection of books, including a coloring book, an adult coloring book of paranormal monsters. But you do have a wide range of interests in the paranormal. And we can talk for a second about your training as an exorcist, perhaps, before we get to some local legends, because this is really something kind of unique in our world today. You don't really hear about exorcists all over the place. And of course, exorcism was aggrandized by the 1973 film, The Exorcist, and there have been any number of films out after that. Why don't you give us kind of an overview of what is actually a possession?
Well, there for me, I studied it in the Protestant vein, which is very close to the Catholic vein, which was where Malachi Martin comes from, and a lot of other pastors and priests who do talk about stuff like this. In my tradition, it's there are 2 different levels. Now, possession, and on my training, it's an all and done type of thing, and there are deeper type. But it, on a psychological level, there's a disconnect of the self, and something else takes control. But that is incredibly rare. I've been talked with various producers trying to do exorcism shows, and every season they try and have a bunch of them on. But really, real trained exorcists don't like to do that in the camera, because it's not a, you know, magic hocus pocus, I'll lay my hands on you and you're all good. That stuff's like for healing, but for exorcism, it's really a psychological thing that you do counseling with. It has a lot of depth to it that you have to also follow up with counseling with traditional psychology, just to make sure the person's okay. So it's all on the up and up, no mystical mumbo jumbo type stuff. It's actually helping people with deep rooted problems that somehow manifest. The more common thing that people confuse is oppression. Oppression can run the gamut from odd depression that just sneaks up on you. You know, there's seasonal depression and clinical depression, but there's sometimes this stuff that you can tell that you're under an assault. And that's what it is. Satan is the father of lies, and he wants to harm humanity according to the Judeo-Christian belief system. For me, I try and shed away the dogma and get to the basic beliefs, because they do go back to the ancient times, that there is a malevolent force out there somehow generated to destroy humanity, to make us not excel to where we're supposed to be, and to cause doubt and hurt and pain inside of us. And some of that manifests as depression, but sometimes, you know, it's just the world and the weight upon you leaves you vulnerable to negative thoughts. And really, that's what demonic oppression is. It's negativity. My fiance's a healer, and she's always stressing, she counsels pastors, and she's always focusing on the positive, because my view on this is spiritual warfare. no matter what you believe, if it's an actual persona of an evil malignant force, or if it's something that's manifesting in your psychological self, your id, the impact's the same. So you have to address that in a positive way, a powerful way, and know that God is with you. The light is with you. If you focus on light and love, then it just adds more energy and positivity. So that's where I'm focused on that now.
That kind of possession, it's maybe not as intense as you would see in the movies. How often does an actual movie-like possession happen? Or do you think that tends to more than often be just a psychological trauma?
A lot of time it's psychological trauma. I get called all the time for people who think they're possessed, or their spouse is possessed, or their children are possessed. I have a real big problem with children being possessed. I was trained, my course was Power Encounter in seminary with an exorcist from the South. And some of the guys there who were training also thought that their children were possessed. And I've been called to possessions for children. And usually it's an influence that they watch movies where they talk about Satan and stuff. So they think Satan's a person and they talk to it. And it's just bad behavior. It's the terrible twos. That can be demonic. So when you're not used to that or not ready for it, it can be an overpowering force. So of all the cases, I would say it's like half of 1% that are possession. For a violent possession, I mean, you really could count it on a handful. There are things that happen that are overwhelming to people, and they go into this panic mode. And something does take over. So it's like an animalistic part of ourselves that takes over. And I have found, too, that that is a part that could open yourself up to different forces. But real possession is incredibly rare. If you think you're possessed, you probably aren't. Or if you think somebody's possessed, they probably aren't. It's usually a psychological problem.
It's actually in the Bible, correct, that there was an episode where Jesus cast out demons and they were put into swine, which ran off. So it is historically, biblically, a known thing, actual possession.
There are forces out there beyond our comprehension. They really are. Good and evil.
Good and evil. But do you think Satan is hands-on, or do you think it's a whole bunch of other factors? This isn't when you think of the movie The Exorcist, do you think that there's a devil in this poor person kind of thing? These possessions are, you're open to malevolent forces. It's not necessarily a particular demon or malevolent being who's maybe doing the possession. Is it just like a general sense of spiritual malaise?
What I have found that when they specifically name a demon, there's thousands and thousands of names of demons out there. Are there thousands of demons? Yeah. But usually they're in categories. And I think that they're actually something that, if you go way back into ancient Sumeria, they had the same categories as we do now in our theology. Spirits that want to make you tear your flesh off and cut yourself, spirits that want to make you throw yourself off of buildings, and self-harming, and those are spirits. Names to them really are, because language changes, but the meanings are the same. The background meanings of the names are the same, so that's the type. So are we dealing with an actual intelligence? Sometimes when it affects a human being, we manifest things in our lives. When we're focused on negative things, there's an old idiom, comes from Babylon 5, if you're a sci-fi fan, but it comes from truth, that when you study evil, evil studies you. So there is an intelligent evil out there. Is there a Satan? Zoroastrianism is an ancient monotheistic religion, but it's also a dualistic religion, that their evil persona of the deity is an active force. And it's not as powerful in Judeo-Christianity, but there is an active force out there that manifests in our lives. The thing is, even if you believe in the hierarchy of angels and beings that are in the Bible, but then are put in dogma in a way, that really is kind of extra biblical. If you do that, then, you know, the angels have fallen, a third of them. But you have two thirds that didn't. So you have twice as many good guys on your side.
Have you ever found yourself afraid in a situation where you had to do some exorcism related activity?
You know, it's very chilling when the things manifest. And I've had many things that I've witnessed manifest. Cold voices, languages, one woman who is really small and incredible strength. But you get past that and you see why they're going through that, and is there's always trauma there. So you focus on that. Of course, it's scary, but, you know, there's nothing that can hurt you. Like in haunted places, though, I've never really had a fear. You do get a fear spirit upon you once in a while. But usually with the things like that, you know, you see in all the Ghost Hunter movies, people running away and stuff. We just confront it and tell it to go away, and it will. Whatever it is, if it's out external or internal,
it will leave on its own once you push it.
You have command. You have command. As a Christian, you have a command in Christ. And as a being, you have a command of yourself.
So there's hope. So if you're sitting at home listening to this and you're like, I'm suffering from some things that aren't normal, there is hope out there.
Yes, you are on the winning side.
So who do you contact? Like if you feel that you are spiritually being assaulted, who would you go to if you were a lay person?
You can go to your local pastor or priest. Some are trained, some are not trained. And sadly, many, when you come to them, I mean, I've had people call me asking for help across the country, and I've tried to contact pastors to no avail. So sometimes it might be best to contact a paranormal team or a spiritual advisor type of person. And there are many of them out there now who are life coaches, who are actually spiritual mentors. But just get in contact with somebody who will help you how to fight it. Many priests, especially in the Erie area, are trained in that area. So, and there are many evangelicals who are trained in that area as well. They call it deliverance or power encounter is how I was trained.
Power encounter. That's a wonderful resource. I'll see if I can find some resources. So when this is over, we can put it up in the hashtags and the links on the Better Than Monkeys episode so that people can check it out if they think they need some kind of a help. Now, you said a few minutes ago, you had mentioned you talked to paranormal groups. Well, just a few years back, I went to the Waterford Hotel. It's a well-known haunted location here in the Erie area. And across the street from the Waterford Hotel is a residence house. And we went over and they kind of had a little dinner. They told us what we were going to do for the evening. And then we went ghost hunting. And you paired up with part of the paranormal team that was doing this investigation. They were from Pittsburgh. And at one point in the evening, we ended up over at the house across the street from the Haunted Eagle Hotel, the Waterford Hotel. And they were asking questions like you would see on the television shows, the ghost hunters. They had their little flashlights set out and they're, you know, turn the flashlight on if you're here, turn the flashlight off. And they were making some things happen. We don't know exactly why. It could be anything. It could be a vibration turning a flashlight on and off. We don't know. But they were asking, they were getting some kind of what they were expecting were responses. So it was me and another girl sitting in this room with these investigators, and it was all dark and they're just asking questions. And one of the questions they asked was, were you ever in the war? Were you a soldier? And I distinctly heard audibly, no, that clear, right? And then I sat on it. I didn't say anything. I just sat there like, what did I do? And like 5 minutes went by and this was really eating at me. And so I walked over to the other girl on the other side of the room and I said, this is going to sound stupid, but when she asked if you were a soldier, were you ever in the war? I distinctly heard, and the girl goes, no. Hmm. And I'm like, yeah, I heard it. And she goes, I heard it too. It was clear as day, but we were all together. There's nobody else in the room would have said that. And so that was like, aside from the flashlights turning on and off, which could be mumbo jumbo, who knows? That was a pretty ghostly encounter from what I would understand. There could be any reason for that, but if I was just having a psychological moment of of confusion or hysteria, somebody else wouldn't have heard the exact same thing at the exact same time. How do you account for experiences people are having at hauntings? If when you die, you're supposed to go according to church rules, heaven or hell, or maybe spend some time in purgatory, who's stuck here on the earth and how does that happen?
Well, it's actually the historical and the ghost hunting, well, paranormal investigator is the proper term really for them. Their terminology is pretty close, the same, that when you die, you are an unrested soul. It goes actually back to an ancient Greece tradition. And so you wander the earth. Some of them hang around graveyards. Actually, the word demon comes from a spirit that lingers in a graveyard. So those type of things, traditionally, they're dead beings who are either bad people or good people, but for some reason they can't go to the other side and they're tortured soul. That's why sometimes with the traditional, you know, weights of iron chain around them, because it's their souls weighted down to the earth, because they can't go on. I personally have a different approach. When it comes to spirits, I've encountered many different type of spirits. Actually, my beginning of the spirituality was sort of a shamanistic type thing. Carlos Castaneda and the whole traditional shaman type of thing. And I did encounter things. I've encountered different types of spirits. And when I go into a haunted house, I've encountered things, had back and forth with different things. My church in Erie had all kinds of audible things happen. Sometimes you could go down in the basement, you could hear children playing. It was really kind of cool. We had a girl's voice say it's okay to die, all kinds of things. Lights and dark shadows, both. It was really interesting. But are they humans? Are they human souls? I found that there's a lot of trickster spirits, these things that, whatever they are, manifest, they like attention. So if they can pretend to be somebody, they will, you know, because they feed off of energy somehow. I think emotional energy somehow interacts and manifests them somehow. And who knows, we might even manifest them ourselves, because I think we're powerful spiritual beings inside. But when it comes to actual people who passed on and come back as spirits, I've encountered that. And how I know that it's them, and what I've seen over and over, is when past loved ones come and visit their loved ones and let them know that they're okay. And they do that by physical manifestation, by phone contact, by odd things. It's just amazing when people pass on. I was actually going to write a book about that, Ushers Through the Veil, because it seems that I've talked to a lot of hospice workers and nurses, and sometimes it doesn't always happen, but sometimes amazing things happen. Angels manifest, lights, balls of lights glowing around, voices singing in an archangel choir out of nowhere.
And these might not be trapped souls, because if you move on, is there any reason why you couldn't come back from a better place to let everybody know you're doing well?
That's the thing. You know, where do we get the guardian angel mythology from? Because it's not biblical, but something happens to loved ones. Some people become angelic beings, and their duty is to watch over people and to care for people. It's not biblical or scriptural, but it seems to be there. I've actually had angel encounters myself a couple of times. They come to me as African-American people dressed in certain period clothing, always warning me of danger. Never, it's always a warning. I have African-American roots myself, even though I'm very white. So I think maybe there's a mystic connection there. And I'm also Native American, so I get a weird connection too, especially in Erie with some of the mystic animals from the Erie Native Americans.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys from WQLN NPR. I'm Brian Hanna, and today's guest on Better Than Monkeys is the paranormal pastor, Robin Swope. Well, speaking of mystic animals, there's one that's not terribly well known, but it's maybe not even an animal. Back in the 1970s, there is a legend of a sheep-like man living in Waterford, and some have referred to it as the sheep squatch or the sheep man. And as the legend goes, he would hang around the old Waterford covered bridge, and he would jump down on unsuspecting people. He would run through fields and attack farm animals, always looking for some other victim. Are you familiar with this legend?
Oh yeah, from the late 60s to the early 70s, a lot of people had encounters. It was kind of odd. But the sheep squatch thing is actually after I published a story on it, it kind of went viral a little bit. Got in contact with Monsters and Mysteries, one of the shows I did some research for, and it happens that there's a lot of sheep squatches out there.
And it's like a large woolly man with horns on his head and maybe even hooves, who kind of prowls the fields and woods around certain areas, certain villages. I guess there's another large sheep squatch legend in Virginia, West Virginia.
Yep, Arkansas, yeah.
Bigfoot and sheep squatch, those are kind of manifested anthropomorphic projections of ourselves. You tend to deal more with spiritual and psychological things, correct?
You know, it's really weird. I've had more encounters with cryptids than anything else.
Oh, really? See, I would have thought it would have been the other way.
No, it's really weird. Yeah.
Well, I also have a Bigfoot story. I told it to Stan Gordon when I had him on a couple of weeks back, which is I was at the Pennsylvania Bigfoot convention down in Gannett, Pennsylvania with Eric Altman, of course. And the gentleman in front of me was talking to a well-known Bigfoot expert about something he saw. He said he was driving one night and something big stepped over a guardrail, walked across the road in just a couple of steps and disappeared over the other bank. And the gentleman asked, well, how big was this? He says, well, he crossed a two-lane street in like three steps, just boom, 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 and then right up the other bank. And the expert said, well, I think you saw a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot. And the guy goes, no. And he goes, well, what do you think it was? And he goes, well, maybe it was just like a bear or something. And he goes, well, was it on 2 feet? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, well, bears have little tiny legs. So the odds of a bear just walking upright over a guardrail and then across a road and then up a hill are pretty, pretty slim. So it does sound to me like you may have seen a Bigfoot. And the guy goes, no. So he was looking for answers, but he didn't really want to hear what the answer might have been. You know, that's my favorite kind of Bigfoot encounter, because it's not somebody like, I saw myself a Bigfoot. It's not happening that way. It's somebody who saw something they can't explain.
That's it. You know, and I use one of Stan's illustrations a whole lot, almost in every interview. And he probably gave you the same illustration in a way about the group who is underneath the streetlights, and about 30 of them, they saw a UFO. Half of them saw it, half of them did not.
Right.
So it's very much an experiential, a personal thing.
And is that how most paranormal encounters happen? It's experiential?
Yeah. I found that some people are sensitive and they have multiple types of encounters. Some stick around some type of range, but some have broad. And sometimes they don't even understand what they are. But a lot of them start when you're a child and you're visited by some sort of being at the foot of your bed or side of your bed. Sometimes you find out it's a relative. And the whole guardian angel thing there too. But right. That seems to be with children what opens it, and it might grow or become neutral for a while and then reemerges. And I call it a catalyst moment. Some people have a little older with different things. But once you have one supernatural experience with one of these things, UFOs, creatures, ghosts, spirits, suddenly the world opens up. You're in a whole new world that things happen around you that you encounter.
Is this something we need to be afraid of, or is this something that we can let our curiosity run a little wild?
You know what? As a pastor and a Christian, I'm a normal guy. I doubt all the time, because it's an amazing thing having, Jesus, God in the flesh, come and die and resurrect again. Is it true? Are there angels? And I tell you this stuff, and it happens to me every year, something new, sometimes funny, but it really strengthens my faith, because there's something out there. Does our dogma have it down straight? Dogma's made by man, but the eternal truths are there. So right. I think it's an inspiration to know that after we die, there's something else. It's kind of awesome.
That is kind of awesome. It's a great way to look at it. So rather than being afraid, it's a wonderful way to look at it is there's something bigger than us out there, and here it is. Here's a glimpse, a rare glimpse. There are so many wonderful little folklore bits about the Erie, Pennsylvania area, everywhere from UFOs landing on the beach to monsters in the woods. There's also all kinds of murder mysteries like Axe Murder Hollow. Axe Murder Hollow is now mostly a subdivision, but when I was growing up, Axe Murder Hollow was a little wooded area over towards Fairview. Do you want to give us a little insight into Axe Murder Hollow, and is it really a thing? Was there a murder?
That was an interesting thing for me to investigate. And it's detailed in my Eerie book. So people go there. It was a very remote location. It was right by the Weiss Library, and it was about a 3-mile stretch of woods. There was sometimes homeless people would set camp there. They would think there were gypsies, you'd hear. There's old foundations from farms there. So the story was that there was a farmer there who went crazy and killed his wife with an axe. And that's where some of the foundations are. Also, if you go there at night, you'll be surrounded, and that somebody there with an axe will appear and they'll come after you. And legends are that people have been killed there and all that. But if you go into the police records, nobody really has died there. However, there was an abduction of an Edinburgh student in the 60s, and she was murdered and her body was dumped there. And in the 70s and 80s, it became a very popular suicide spot because it was, isolated. So there was a lot of death associated there. And so, of course, when things like that happen, stuff can manifest. But the interesting thing, and it's the same thing with the bridge. Boy, I forgot what its name is.
Gudgeonville?
Yes, the Gudgeonville Bridge. Mm-hmm. There's some things that happened there, too. The mule died. There's a little girl who fell off a cliff. So I had parishioners who would see shadow creatures go through the bridge, and all kinds of weird things manifest. But there was only a mule dying and a little girl falling off. There's nothing really hard evidence of these things are lingering over, but the focus of people upon it manifests things. I found all over Erie. Even at the vampire crypt.
Yeah, that was going to be my next topic. There's a mausoleum in the Erie Cemetery that is often referred to as the vampire crypt. There's no name on the crypt, but it has a unique floral carving above the door, which some people say looks like a bat. And it's stained pretty black and gray just from over the years, the stones weathering and trees dropping sap on the stones. So it's kind of a dark and scary crypt. But from what I understand, it belongs to a family called the Brown family. Mm-hmm. And it's also possible nobody is actually buried in there. I've heard that.
Mm-hmm. So the legend is, if you look at it, there's the stone above the lintel stone has the name. But if you look at this crypt, it looks like it's almost chiseled out. And there's a flourish above the gated entrance that looks like a V for vampire, or even looks like a bat. The legend is that in the 1800s, as they were moving bodies in 1850 to the graveyard, Erie Cemetery, from different graveyards around the county, there was some trouble with this crypt. It kept being open, and people were being assaulted, blood drained, victims everywhere, and the maintenance guy saw somebody go into the crypt. So he burnt the crypt. That's why it's all black, and he killed the vampire. But the ghost appeared again in the 60s and lured somebody out. As they were parting on top of the crypt, pushed him off. So he went to the hospital, and a ghost followed him there, and he fell off the hospital and killed him. Also, rabid ghost demon dogs will attack you if you go there at night. So those are the legends. The truth is that there were supposedly 7 people buried there. The Browns acquired it afterwards. They were all moved in 1851 when the cemetery was established. So there are different bodies from different people there. And the last one was a baby who there's no birth certificate or death certificate for. Those are the rumors and those are the facts if you go to the cemetery. But again, it manifests all kinds of stuff. The ghost dogs, that's something that is a new urban legend. And the man falling off the crypt and going to the hospital. A lot of people have done that. So it is a spot that attracts people that can manifest things itself.
Is that the only creepy story that comes out of the Erie Cemetery?
There is a witch's circle that is very close to it, that's more off to the east side of the cemetery as you come in. If you look at it, it's a circular area of tombstones that are all black as well. Looks like they've been burnt. And what the story is that they had a coven there. They're in a circle, and they did something horrible, and hell came up and burnt them alive, and they burnt down and turned into tombstones. But if you look at the stones, they're just 15-year-old boys.
Right.
Yeah, and what happened there is, a lot of times in the old burials, they buried people around a tree so they could find it. When the tree goes, you have a bunch of tombstones in a circle. So right. that's the origin. And Erie was an industrial town, so both the graveyard, the witch's circle, and the vampire's crypt are both encrusted with pollution that turned the stone black.
Or it was burned to kill a vampire. So we should also talk about actually talk about the ghosts of the War of 1812, because that's a very prominent topic here in the city by the bay. Of course, Commodore Perry led the fleet to defeat the British in the War of 1812 here right in the bays surrounding Lake Erie and Erie, Pennsylvania. And they spent some time wintering here in the lagoons of Presque Isle, which is a long sandbar that reaches out into the lake, attaches itself to Erie, Pennsylvania. And there was a particularly rough winter in the winter of 1813. And you mentioned a little bit earlier that a smallpox epidemic broke out and many soldiers died, as well as a lot of people who helped with the ships. And they were disposed of in an odd way. And the legend has it that if you walk along Graveyard Pond and Misery Bay at night, you will see the ghosts of these fallen sailors. Do you want to give us a little insight into that?
Yeah, so there was a legend there that during the smallpox epidemic, all the officers were buried in a proper way across the bay on a sandbar that might or might not exist there anymore by the old trailer RV area up there. But the slaves, the Indians, and those who just volunteered, if they had died, legend had is it, and even the Niagara used to do it, as they wrapped the bodies in canvas with cannonballs and put them in the lake. So that's why it's called Graveyard Pond. So we don't know if it's true. They said they did some dredging there and they couldn't find it, but the only dredging they did was by the entrance where the grated bridge is. But supposedly they put them farther in, basically out of respect too.
Right.
I was there in 2009 looking into the UFO incident, and I was talking to some of the rangers there, and they were telling me that just recently in 2009, the week before in July, there's a fog bank that rolled in on Beach 11, which is very close to Graveyard Pond. They're an interconnected system. And some people saw what they thought were shadow creatures in like bathrobes, people from with different hats and stuff coming through the fog and then disappearing. So if you look at that, in the War of 1812, they wore very heavy overcoats. They could be indistinguishable from bathrobes today. So, and I heard from another congregant in Erie who has since passed in the 50s, he used to go there out to the peninsula at night when there was not so much security back then with his dates. And they, so if the fog was rolling in, they would see soldiers walking down the road. So odd things.
Still could happen. You know, it's still there today. You can drive across that grated metal bridge. You can take a walk along Graveyard Pond on a spooky October afternoon. I think you have to be out before sunset, but you know, it gets a little spooky starting about 5 o'clock. So you still have a chance this October to get out to Presque Isle and maybe see the ghosts of some past American and British sailors walking along Graveyard Pond. And you mentioned a UFO incident on Presque Isle. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
So actually, Project Blue Book was a Air Force investigative team that would respond to UFO incidents. And there was a very, very, they did thousands of investigations. Only a handful were unexplained. And Erie has one of those. So it was 66, July 31st. Two groups of singles, one with two kids, met there and were having a picnic, and they got stuck in the sand where the volleyball net is now. It's all sand in the parking lot, and you could easily get stuck there, and that's what happened. So another guy went, one of the guys went to get help, and while that happened, park rangers came by and left. And after the park rangers came by and left, they didn't help because they had a guy going for a truck. They saw this weird UFO shaped like a mushroom coming over the bay, over the lake, and settle down into the wooded area. Just then the cops came back, and remaining guy and the cops went into the woods to see what that was. While they were there, the two ladies and two children were in the car, and they saw this giant hairy creature come from the woods, and it attacked their car and left scrapes on the car. They screamed and honked the horn. Everybody came back. The creature disappeared somehow. So the UFO was not found. The state police were called. The Air Force came in. Project Blue Book came in. They found hair samples on a tree. They found weird footprints and a landing spot. And the landing spot and the footprints had a weird gel in them. Nothing was ever reported about what that was. There was an in-depth investigation. They said that the ladies were just, they had mental health problems. And actually, there was a mental health assessment that was in a prominent journal, and it really legitimized it. She did encounter something. And like Stan Gordon, he has a book about the connection between UFOs and Bigfoot. So something was happening there, and it was unexplained. And a lot of news and reporters try to write it off, and some of the park rangers write it off as, well, they just got caught making out. No, it was families. There was children there too.
Right. And it was a mass sighting. And from what I understand, nobody ever recanted their story.
No. Yeah. And eight other people saw the UFO as it traveled over Erie and across the bay into Presque Isle.
So when things like this happen, you know, in today's day of the immediate picture, the cell phone, the immediate recording abilities, are there still strange things? All these things we were talking about happened in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Are there still interesting events taking place now?
Oh, yeah. Talking often UFOs, I've personally seen giant triangles. I mean, I saw one in New York area that was at least three miles long, believe it or not. And it was there, slowly went over. I gathered people around and say, look at that. And they're like, wow, that's really weird. I'm like, it's more than weird. Yeah. So there's people are seeing crafts. People are all kinds of weird things, spirits, creatures. Cryptids are on the increase everywhere.
And, you know, recently Lauren Coleman was an interview on Better Than Monkeys, and he talked about all the different cryptids that are still out there. But people are still having sightings and encounters with what we would know as Bigfoot or dogmen or other little tiny people out in the woods. These things happen all the time. And a lot of these people, you would think they're just telling a tall tale, try to get a rise out of somebody. But a lot of these people will take that right to their grave with them.
2 years ago, I had two kids who were out playing in a field. I took them to the Erie Park out in Girard. I forget what it's exactly called, but it's an overlook to the lake. And so they're playing, and I'm looking over, and I'm like, I see these weird bumps in the lake. And I call them over. Did you see that over there too? And it was something in the lake. And the lake does have a legend that there's a serpent in there as well. In the 1860s, I believe, or 80s, there's a lot of sightings. And I've known some people who said they are out in the beach over in Northeast, and they saw this giant snake-like creature that was out in the water. So there's all kinds of stuff around us. And I've known professional pilots in Erie who swear there's, you know, we all have the orange lanterns or Japanese lanterns and they're not UFOs. But this person was actually in a plane and he saw a orange light actually make a left 45 degree turn and then travel on against the wind. So they're everywhere.
They are everywhere. And, you know, I've also heard that Lake Erie is among the shallowest of the lakes, averaging about 68 or 70 feet. Some of the Great Lakes get up to 1,300, 1,400 feet deep. So we're very shallow. So I've also heard that that makes it a really good place for underwater shenanigans, for craft that want to land and then just rest or refuel or regroup or do some exploration, because they don't have to go down 1,000 feet. They can just go down 70 feet, hide there until it's appropriate to leave, and then back they go. So Erie is full. What do you think makes Erie such a hotbed for legends and strange phenomena?
You know, it's really weird. I'm sensitive myself. You know, I don't, like a lot of the psychics and stuff, I'll get the same vibes going into places like that. So Erie has some cities have a vibe. Some cities have a spirit. I was in Newcastle. Newcastle had a very odd spirit. And Erie has an odd spirit too. I think what it is if you look back in history, when they started digging the railroads, they came across skeletons after skeletons. There's thousands of Indian burial grounds all across Erie County that have been desecrated by modern advancement from turning graveyards into farms and farms into living facilities. So when you disturb sacred ground, things happen. So I think a lot of it has to do with that or the violence that actually happened on the ground, because that's where all the dead bodies came from. They say there's thousands of bodies they found, the pioneers, where the Bayfront and Sixth Street connect.
Well, you know, we're very close to the mound builders, the Native Americans who would build these beautiful burial mounds. West Virginia is rife with them, and they extend on up into Pennsylvania. And I've also heard that there were, in the 1800s, even late 1700s, burial mounds all over Erie County.
Yes, all over in Girard. They just littered everywhere. And in fact, in 1830, during the Trail of Tears, with a lot of the dislocated Erie Indians who were assimilated to the Seneca, they came back and they had a ritual to say goodbye to all the mounds that were in the area, all the farms. There's a few left. There's one out by Corey. There's half of one in Wintergreen Gorge. They're all protected. The one out in Linesville, it's in a farm and it's just being plowed over. They have an agreement with the Native Americans to never disturb it or dig it up.
Right. What a wonderful piece of history. If you go to Moundsville, West Virginia, home to one of the most haunted prisons in the United States, but it's also home to one of the largest burial mounds that's still visible today. It's a beautiful piece of area. Do you think
one of the weird things about the mounds in Erie, though, is the amount of giant skeletons found in them. I guess there's about six, and that's kind of rare. So there's all kinds of.
When you hear a story about that, giant skeletons, that's not an unusual thing. We've heard about it forever. You know, David and Goliath, he was a giant, supposedly. And these are just extraordinarily tall people. You hear about that, but you never really get to see the skeletons. Yeah. But so many people have talked about it through the ages that you have to wonder where those skeletons ended up. And when you're talking about unusually tall people, there's also another spiritual force called the Nephilim. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us what that is?
Well, I'm with my new church, I'm sort of focusing on spirituality. I actually have a series going through the Bible, and I'm in Genesis 6 actually right now. So focusing on the Nephilim. The word Nephilim, it's being commandeered by ancient aliens as sort of a spiritual type of alien type of thing. But Nephilim really is scripturally when the daughters of men and the sons of God married or mated and had babies, and they were men of renown, the Bible says, and the Nephilim. And the Nephilim were then, and they carried on. So the word Nephilim, if you look into it, it actually means giant. Some will say fallen one, because there's a root there, and that's where we get fallen angels. And that's where the demons come from. It's an ancient church myth that the Nephilim died, and that's the demons. That's where the demons come from. They're not the fallen angels, but the subordinate.
So do they still exist today?
Nephilim, you know, they're, to tell you the truth, it's like the Anunnaki that the ancient aliens have commandeered, sort of. The Anunnaki were ancient, basically angels, the Sumerian word for angels. The Anunnaki, were they a race? I don't know, because they all vanished with the flood as well. So who knows? Were they some sort of mixed race that before the flood, the antediluvian kings? It's a fascinating thing to think about. Do they exist physically? Who knows? They could. There's a lot of conjecture exactly what UFOs are. If they're not aliens, do they come from around here, from in the hollow earth, all that type of thing, you know?
Right.
So who knows? Spiritually wise, if you do believe that they're demons, then they're all around us.
Well, when you got into becoming a paranormal investigator and studying this kind of stuff, do you find you run into people who tend to snicker or mock your interest in the field, or do you find people tend to be interested in something they don't understand?
I find that the professional theologians and professional in religion mock sometimes, unless you talk to them privately, and then they've had experiences. And the general populace, people, I mean, it's a connection. I started the paranormal pastor thing, and it's just been amazing, you know, without, I mean, it's been a lot of viewers, millions of views on YouTube and stuff like that. So there, it wasn't me. I knew it struck a current of something, that there are a lot of people who are spiritual and still maybe religious, but the spiritual depth we all perceive, and we want answers, and we want to know what that really is. And so all of us are, we have a Judeo-Christian background, you know, God, Jesus, angels. Where does it all connect with the stuff we're actually experiencing in life? So it's a great mystery, but it's really cool, because, you know, if you do put it in the Judeo-Christian worldview, then you have answers, and comforting answers. And if you do depth into it, you know, are there demons all around us? Yeah. But do they have influence in our life? No. How you have influence in your life is positive thinking or negative thinking. And that's the way those things manifest.
Do you find other pastors kind of jump on the bandwagon with you from time to time? Do you have other compatriots in this field?
Somewhat. There are those out there. There are a lot of people, and I used to expose a little bit, you know, the snake oil salesmen who pretend to have training or pretend to be an exorcist or all that, and live off the fear of people. So that's sort of what I combat, because we don't have to live in fear. We're people of hope. The power of being positive, the power of love and acceptance and respect and dignity, it's just amazing. So that's where I'm focusing now on with my ministry, is positive thinking, love, and empowerment of people against the negative, because, my goodness, we have so much negative in the world now today.
Absolutely. And, you know, having a hobby that's a little fun, even if it's a little off center, like hunting Bigfoot or ghost hunting, you know, if you do it right and you do it correctly and you do it with the honest scientific desire to find something, maybe that's not on, it's maybe perhaps not discovered yet. If you go into it, I think with a scientific brain, you probably have very little to fear. But the reality is there's a lot of stuff we don't know about the world. We think we know everything now, but there's so much we don't know. And I think if we approach this from a scientific aspect, but still follow what you said, be positive, try to keep yourself in the light. Exploring this shouldn't cause anyone any harm, should it?
No. It's actually, you know, what's really funny, back when Christianity first started, there's all kinds of different beliefs, and they were condensed down and organized by the church, and some thoughts were discarded, but they're coming back. And that's what it is. It's just really spirituality and being positive and exploring the mystery of life.
That's a great way to end, exploring the mystery of life. And we want you all to go and explore the mystery of life. And a great starting off point is by going to Amazon.com or any of your major booksellers, because you do have 7 books available right now. How do people find them?
You can go to Amazon. They're all on Amazon. Or Barnes & Noble's will have the Eerie Eerie book. And actually some of the supermarkets will.
If you're interested, all you have to do is do a Google search and you will find them. They're really fun. I have the Eerie Eerie book and I have the Slender Man book. So they're really wonderfully written, great ways to explore our local mysteries and some stuff that it's kind of worldwide mysteries. You're a great author. So it's been wonderful to have you on today. Thanks for spending a little time. How many of these podcast kind of things do you do a year now that podcasting is such a popular event?
You know, not as much as I used to.
Really?
Just because it's become so popular, yeah. And I've sort of taken this, the new church role, spirituality stuff, a little more focused on that.
So right.
Only when it comes, when a mystery appears, because I'm by the, you know, that one Skinwalker Ranch.
Oh, yeah, you're close.
Very yeah. close. Actually, I have congregants who live right next to it.
So. Wow. That's kind of fun.
New to happen.
Are you allowed to go and look?
I hope so. We'll find out.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have credentials now. You should be able to flash your card and get right in and look around the Skinwalker Ranch. Well, thank you so much, Reverend Robin Swope, for joining us here, the paranormal pastor. And again, you can find any of his books by just doing a quick Google search. S-W-O-P-E is how you spell that last name. Thanks for being so generous with your time today. And thanks for joining us for this edition of Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN NPR. It was great to have you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Better Than Monkeys is an original podcast of WQLN NPR. I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for BTM. If you'd like to check out more episodes, you can find them at wqln.org/BTM or on any major podcast platform. Again, I'm Brian Hanna, and thanks for joining me for a very special Halloween edition of Better Than Monkeys from WQLN NPR. Stay scary, everybody.